You're listening to the daily radio ministry of Pastor Sandy Adams of Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain in Atlanta, Georgia. Pastor Sandy is currently teaching through the Gospel of Matthew. Now here's Pastor Sandy in Matthew chapter 5 with today's edition of Sandy Adams Radio.
There was once an old farmer who attended church every single Sunday. He said he always benefited from the service. He always enjoyed the sermon. And yet he told his friend, "To tell you the truth, I've never heard a sermon that I didn't get something good out of it." Well, after thinking about it for a while, his buddy responded, "Yeah, me too, but I've had some mighty close calls." I am sure that we've all had some mighty close calls. But the sermon that Jesus delivers here in Matthew chapters 5 through 7 are definitely not a close call. If sermons were pizzas, the Sermon on the Mount would be a pizza supreme. Walk into most first century Jewish synagogues and you would find a boring rabbi and a snoring congregation. The Jewish Talmud contains specimens of sermons taught by the rabbis. A.T. Robertson sums them up. They are the driest, dullest collection of disjointed comments on every conceivable problem in the history of mankind. These rabbinical sermons resembled frozen, cardboard-like pizzas, whereas the Sermon on the Mount had thick sauce and chewy crust and delicious toppings. It was a sermon supreme. For the folks sitting on that grassy knoll overlooking the Sea of Galilee, those who first heard Jesus' sermon, this was a sermon that they would never, ever forget. Jesus had been traveling the countryside, preaching to the people that the kingdom of heaven was at hand. And now he explains the nature of his kingdom. The Sermon on the Mount could be called the Christian Manifesto. It is the very heart of Jesus' message. We'll begin in verse 1. "And seeing the multitudes, he went up on a mountain." Whenever we visit Israel, we always stop at the traditional site of the Mount of Beatitudes. It's on the northwest shore of the Sea of Galilee. And there's a knoll that kind of rises up from the shore of the lake, overlooks the Sea of Galilee. This is where we believe that Jesus first spoke this sermon. As the hill slopes upward there along the shore, it wraps around a banana grove. It sort of forms an outdoor amphitheater. You can stand on a ridge and you can be heard hundreds of feet away. The acoustics there are perfect for delivering a sermon to a large crowd. Jesus must have picked it out especially for this sermon. He says, "And when he was seated with his disciples," or when he was seated, "his disciples came to him." Notice Jesus sits to teach. You know, today a speaker will usually stand when he begins to teach. But the rabbi in the synagogue would always sit. What you said while you were walking or while you were standing was considered informal and off the record. But when you took a seat, that's when you were making an official statement. Today, when a university's physics department creates a teaching position, it's known as the chair of physics. When Jesus sat down to teach, his disciples knew that he was about to conduct official business, issue a heavy statement. Now remember, Jesus came teaching that the kingdom of heaven was at hand. Jesus had brought heaven to earth. He had gone behind enemy lines in coming into this world to establish the kingdom of heaven among the kingdoms of men. But what were the values and the priorities of his kingdom? Jesus answers that question in this sermon. Jesus reveals the values of heaven, and he shows how they diametrically oppose to the traits prized on earth. In fact, the first 8 Beatitudes stand out in contrast to the values of this world. Hey, the world admires haughtiness. Heaven admires humility. The world loves to laugh. Heaven listens to our mourning. The world is impressed with force. Heaven loves gentleness. The world is into what's here and now. Heaven hungers for what's spiritual and eternal. The world demands justice, but heaven shows mercy. The world assumes corruption, but heaven expects innocence and purity of heart. The world insists on its own rights. Heaven pursues peace. The world crushes its enemies. Heaven loves its enemies. Aren't you glad? Notice Jesus addresses the Beatitudes in the Sermon on the Mount to his disciples. Verse 1, his disciples came to him. You see, this sermon is for Christians. For the only way to live the life of the kingdom is in relationship to the King. The Sermon on the Mount is not a New Testament law. It's not a moralistic code of behavior. Rather, it is the outgrowth or the byproduct of a life that has been connected to Jesus. One final point of introduction here. Notice the first 8 statements we call the Beatitudes. They're the Beatitudes, not the Do attitudes. You see, at the heart of God's kingdom are attitudes, not actions. The Pharisees said, do, do, do. That was their emphasis, but Jesus said, be, be, be. Frank Sinatra said, do, be, do, be, do. But that doesn't really matter. What matters to God is not what you do, it's what you be. You see, the Pharisees, they did all the right things, but evil lurked in their heart. Whereas Jesus desires a righteousness that comes from the inside out. Remember, Paul was a Pharisee before he became a Christian. And yet after his conversion, he said of the self-righteousness of the Pharisaical life, the self-righteousness that he had manufactured before coming to Christ, he says, I count it but rubbish. And you know from past studies, that word rubbish literally means dung, manure. He says, this emphasis on do, 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 well, it's just that. It's dung. It's rubbish. God knows that if you'll be the right person, you will do the right things. Well, verse 2 tells us, then he opened his mouth and taught them, saying, blessed. The word literally means happy. People assume that happiness is the result of what I acquire, or the fame that what's acclaimed about me, or maybe the things that I accomplish. This is what makes happiness, but not so. Happiness is the result of the right attitude. You could also translate this word blessed not only as happy, but as congratulations. Jesus is saying, congratulations if you have these different attitudes. It's proof that you belong to my kingdom. Well, in rapid fire succession here, let's comment briefly on each of these Beatitudes. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. You know, some folks are full of themselves, but the poor in spirit are just the opposite. They're the ones who look outside of themselves. They're the ones who have thrown themselves on the mercies of God. Jesus will bless their humility and their admitted neediness with the kingdom of heaven. What an irony here. In God's kingdom, the spiritual beggars end up the royal heirs. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Jesus blesses the person who's willing to mourn, who knows when there is a time for tears. Guys, there is sin in us. There is sin around us. And our eyes can't stay dry when we really understand sin's consequences. Glibness is unbecoming of a Christian. The first step in fixing what's broken is realizing that it's broken. Jesus will comfort the person who stops pretending all is well and mourns over their brokenness. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Here's a great definition for meekness, and please don't confuse it with weakness. Meekness is strength, but under restraint. It's choosing to hold back when it's within your power to act. That's what meekness is. You see, a meek person is a person under control. He knows that it is better to win his opponent's respect than to win the game. He knows that souls are more important than the score. Once when Zach was a little guy, I think he was probably 10 or 11 years old, we were playing baseball, I was coaching, he was playing shortstop, and a weak hitter was up. Kid had never got on base. He hit a ground ball Zach's way. And uncharacteristically, Zach scooped the ball up and he airmailed it over the first baseman's head. I was just about to jump on him. When he kind of leaned over to dugout and he kind of winked at me And he sort of said, you know, in a whisper where only I could hear him, he said, "Dad, I just wanted the kid to get on base for a change so he could feel good." That's meekness. And Jesus says, "The meek shall inherit the earth." What does that mean? That means that God trusts authority to people who have the right priority. That's what that means. "Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be filled." What's your driving passion? What yanks your chain? You see, life is full of stuff that creates a bloated feeling for a time. But that's why we call it stuff. It never slakes our spiritual thirst. It just stuffs us. It doesn't satisfy us. Jesus is the true thirst quencher. Jesus alone can satisfy the seeker. That's why we need to seek and knock and ask. Here's the question tonight. Do you hunger for God? Do you hunger and thirst for righteousness? It's been said, "Tell me what you seek, and I'll tell you what you are." "Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy." Hey, apart from God's mercy, heaven is out of my reach. And that's why I need to be merciful. Can I deny you my forgiveness when God forgives me so freely? Can I? Jesus says, "The more mercy you show, the more mercy you'll know." That's why we need to bury the hatchet. We need to cut our brother or sister some slack. We need to show mercy today, for tomorrow we might just need some. "Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God." You know, a cup of coffee can be too strong or it can be too weak, but I'll still drink it. It's a cup of coffee. But a fly in my cup disqualifies that cup of coffee. It makes it intolerable for me. Likewise, my love for God can at times be stronger, can at times be weaker. But it should always be pure. It should always be sincere. Hypocrisy is the fly in our cup. That's why Jesus desires the pure in heart. He desires genuine faith. And he tells us, only the pure in heart shall see God. "Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God." Peacemakers like to fight. Peacemakers confront hostility, and they assault misunderstanding, and they attack problems with peaceful solutions. Peacemakers war for peace. A peacemaker tries to destroy his enemy by turning him into his friend. That's what a peacemaker is all about. And never are we more like God than when we fight for peace. This is why in verse 9, Jesus calls the peacemakers sons of God. "Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." Usually when you take a stand for what's right, those who are in the wrong will take a shot at you. Persecution follows the Christian. It followed Jesus, and it'll follow you. But just remember, folks the world calls chumps, God calls champs. He says, "Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake." And then he says, "Blessed are you when they revile and persecute you and say all kinds of evil against you falsely for my sake. Rejoice and be exceedingly glad, for great is your reward in heaven. For so they persecuted the prophets who were before you." When you stand up for Jesus, those who oppose him will try to bring you down. Don't be surprised when it happens. How often we're bummed out. We come, "Oh, I can't believe it. I'm standing up for Jesus and being persecuted." Why can't you believe it? They persecuted Jesus. They're going to persecute you. Don't be surprised when it happens. Rather, rejoice and be exceedingly glad. Be excited when you get persecuted, for great is your reward in heaven. Hey, we get medals in heaven. We get scars on earth. Now remember, these Beatitudes, we call them the believer's birthmark. The Spirit plants them in our hearts at the point of our conversion. The new birth comes with these Beatitudes, and then as we grow in Christ, we develop them and we nurture them in our lives. In the preamble of the United States Constitution, our founding fathers guaranteed us the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But you know, those founding fathers were wise old goats. Because they knew they couldn't guarantee happiness, only the pursuit of happiness. You know, a lot of people are searching for happiness. But here's the deal. Make happiness your goal, and that is the best way to end up unhappy. Happiness is never the result of a direct pursuit. Always remember, real happiness is the byproduct of living life God's way. Jesus says, "You are the salt of the earth. But if the salt loses its flavor, how shall it be seasoned? It is then good for nothing but to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men." You know, salt served four primary functions. It was a preservative. It kept the meat fresh. It was a seasoning. I mean, what's a bowl of grits without a little salt? It's a thirst producer. Eat a bag of potato chips and you're dying for a Coke. And it was an antiseptic. It was a means of cleaning out a wound. And this is the influence that we should have on the world around us. Our presence should be like a preservative. It should arrest and slow down the corruption going on around us. Our joy should add spice to the blandness and boredom of this world. We are the salt on the grits. Our winsome witness should create a thirst for God in the people that we know. And the love that we show others should help to heal open wounds of the people around us. We're salt, but we're also light. Verse 14, you are the light of the world. Light's primary function is twofold. First, it drives out the darkness. Light exposes misconceptions and dangers and erroneous thinking. Light reveals the truth. And second, light gives off a warmth. It cures the world's coldness. As a man said of his Christian friend, "I felt more alive when I was around him." Do the people that you know, are your friends, the people in your life, do they say the same thing about you? "I felt more alive when I was around her, when I was around him." This is the kind of invigorating influence that we should have on the folks that we know. Hey, we are the salt of the earth. We are the light of the world. Jesus continues, "A city that is set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do they light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a lampstand, and it gives light to all who are in the house. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven." In other words, what good is a light if it's kept under a basket? What's good is a light if it's buried under a candle? You hang the light in the center of the room so everyone can enjoy its benefit. Notice here, Jesus calls us the light of the world, not the light of the church. That means that we need to get out of the church and we need to be involved in the world around us. We need to let our light shine. That's why you need to coach Little League. And you need to get involved in the PTA or the community association or the bowling league. Don't retreat from the world. Jesus says you are the light of the world, but if the people are going to see your light, you have to be around them. You have to be a part of them. Engage the world around you with a deliberate attempt of being a witness for Jesus Christ. I encourage you to do that. You know, there are two reasons why most unbelievers refuse to trust in Jesus. Two reasons why people are non-Christians. First, they've never met a Christian and been exposed to this light and this love, the salt of the earth. There's another reason, though, they're not Christians. It's because they have met a Christian. And that Christian was not what he said he was. Hey, we all have an influence. With some of us, it's positive. With others of us, it's negative. Guys, let's be salt and light. Our job as Christians is to sprinkle and twinkle. Can you say that with me? We're to sprinkle and twinkle. Remember that this week. In verse 17, Jesus makes an important statement. "Do not think that I came to destroy the law or the prophets. I did not come to destroy, but to fulfill." The intent of the law was to show us how to love God and how to love each other. And yet in the first century, the Jews, particularly the Pharisees, they kept the law out of duty, not love. Their righteousness was a loveless, legalistic kind of self-righteousness. In contrast, Jesus obeyed the law's intent. He fulfilled the law with love. You see, here's the problem with the law. It tells me to do loving deeds, but it fails to impart love into my life. Whereas Jesus fills me with His love so that I can then act in loving ways. I like this poem. To work and run the law commands, but gives me neither feet nor hands. Better news the gospel brings. It bids me fly, then gives me wings. Jesus fulfilled the law by imparting His love into our hearts. He provides a means to live the love that the law required. Now, there were rabbis who believed that the Messiah, when He came, would do away with the law and establish a new standard of righteousness. But Jesus respected the law that was given to Moses. The law had lofty goals. The law was all about love. And Jesus wanted to fulfill those goals by empowering folks to love. This is why Jesus reiterates His respect for the law in verse 18. He says, "For assuredly I say to you, till heaven and earth pass away, one jot or one tittle will by no means pass from the law till all is fulfilled." A jot was the smallest letter in the Hebrew alphabet. The tittle was the smallest stroke on the smallest letter in the Hebrew alphabet. The authority and the longevity of the five books of Moses, as well as all the Bible for that matter, is more certain than the sun coming up tomorrow. Jesus said the earth would sooner pass away than this book prove to be unreliable. This book is powerful. This book, its longevity, its authority is trustworthy. Jesus respected the law. We should too. In essence, Jesus is saying, don't you dare fiddle with the tittle. He says, whoever therefore breaks one of the least of these commandments and teaches men so shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever does and teaches them, he shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I say to you that unless your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, you will by no means enter the kingdom of heaven. Jesus didn't do away with the law. Rather, He said that the true life lived out according to the law is going to produce a righteousness greater than the Pharisees. That's what I want to accomplish in your life. Now, in the minds of the disciples who first heard this statement, I'm telling you, this was staggering. This was shocking. For in Jesus' day, the Pharisees were renowned for their diligence in keeping the law. As a matter of fact, the Jews had a saying at the time, went like this: if only two people go to heaven, one will be a scribe and one will be a Pharisee. I mean, the Pharisees were zealous in their efforts to observe the law. They were meticulous to obey the smallest little details. For example, the law said no work on the Sabbath day. But what constitutes work? Well, certainly carrying a load would be work. But what constitutes a load? Well, here's how the Pharisees defined a load: food the weight of a fig, wine for a goblet, milk for one swallow, honey for a wound, oil to anoint a small part of the body, water to moisten an eye patch, paper to write a note, and ink enough to write two letters. That was a load.
Thanks for joining us today on Sandy Adams Radio with our pastor and teacher, Sandy Adams. We come to you from Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain in Atlanta, Georgia. We're currently going through the book of Matthew from the New Testament. Matthew, one of Jesus' disciples, wrote this gospel to present Jesus as the promised King and Messiah of Israel. From the genealogy that ties Jesus to David and Abraham, to the fulfillment of Old Testament prophecies, Matthew emphasizes that Jesus is the culmination of God's plan. Through his teaching, miracles, and life, we see the kingdom of heaven breaking into the world. As we walk through the life of Christ, we're invited to reflect on what it means to follow him as the true king. How does Jesus' kingship influence your life today? If you have any questions about the message you just heard, or if you have any prayer requests, we'd love to hear from you. You can call us at 770-736-2828. Again, that's 770-736-2828. You can also find more information on our website, sandyadams.org. While you're there, you can listen to our other teachings, or you can also download our mobile app to listen to these messages wherever you are. Join us again next time as Pastor Sandy continues to teach through Matthew on Sandy Adams Radio.